This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. D. Keith Mana has written that in his novels he tries to relate traditional Christianity to the concerns of the modern world. In his earlier books, his Christian protagonist's belief run up against issues such as progress, civil rights, pollution, and war. In Mano's latest novel, an Episcopal priest inadvertently ends up running a topless bar and is forced to look at his attitudes towards sex. Mano spent years researching his new novel, Topless. He conducted more than 300 interviews with topless dancers, club owners, bouncers, and customers. This journalistic approach to Mano's fiction comes from the many years he's written for magazines. In researching his articles, he's given blood with winos, tested $5,000 worth of sex equipment, and has bought lunch for bookies, cigarette smugglers, pimps, and Nobel sperm bankers. Keith Mano is the only person to ever appear as a contributing editor on the mastheads of both National Review and Playboy simultaneously. In his new novel, Topless, the priest, Mike Wilson, gets a call from his sister-in-law, Ethel, telling him his brother has disappeared. She wants Wilson to come to New York to run his brother's restaurant, The Smoking Car. Wilson leaves his parish in Nebraska, only to find out the restaurant is really a topless bar. I ask Mano to read a section of the book.
I have just come back from The Smoking Car, and we have trouble. I can't believe this. I just can't believe it. And Ethel shrugs it off. Good God, what am I dealing with here? Wait, from the beginning. I take the Lincoln and I head down to 60th Street and Northern Boulevard. I'm wearing my clerical suit because my cords are filthy and my jeans have a hole in them. I'm full of anticipation. I mean, can I handle this? Sure I can. A restaurant can't be harder to manage than a parish. Probably it's easier. They don't hold you responsible for souls, just for appetites. So, I pull up. It is the weirdest-looking place. Facade like the side of a Long Island Railroad passenger car. A dozen tiny windows set into silver metal. The name is written out in a flashy blue neon. It's at the west end of the block. There's an out-of-business dry cleaner at the corner and a hardware store to the right. I figure, well, they're just starting to serve lunch. So I take my little portfolio with my just-bought three-ring notebook in it, and I set out across Northern Boulevard like I'm about to take a course in human digestion. Naturally, it's so bright outside I can't see for a good few seconds after going through the front door, but I've got this big lasagna of a dumb smile on my face, like, hi, I'm the brother-in-law, welcome to the new regime, my people, and I see what? I see a naked woman. She's hanging down from a trapeze over a tiny stage. Jesus Christ, I am in a topless bar with my collar on. I turn around and blast into the sunshine across the boulevard into the Lincoln, where I proceed to eat my fingers.
This idea of taking an Episcopal priest from a parish in Nebraska and putting him in Queens, where he's managing a topless bar, are you playing with temptation here?
Yes, very much so, and Mike is very aware of the fact. He has good reasons to run this topless bar. You could make a case for him. His brother's disappeared, and his sister-in-law has four little children, and she lies to him and tells him it's just a restaurant, so he comes back to New York thinking, my brother put me through seminary. It's the least I can do to help out. These are my nieces. And he is, you know, the surprise is sprung on him, as we've just heard, and suddenly he is confronted with, well, if I'm playing with fire here. The Lord is says, lead me not into temptation, and so forth. He thinks he can handle it, but he knows there's a lot of danger to the soul there, and of course he's trying to hide his identity.
Do you know where this idea came from?
It came from, it's perfectly consistent with the other novels that I've written, in which I take a Christian and put him in or her in a tremendously pressured situation, like Vietnam, perhaps, or the ghetto, or my first novel, Bishop's Progress, dealt with a bishop facing medical miracles and his how a Christian deals with modern science and so forth. But I've never taken the two poles of our reality, our spiritual pole and our sexual pole, and put them so close together so that sparks fly easily and naturally. It isn't hard to come up with exciting metaphors when you've got a priest and a nude woman in the same situation. So, in a sense, I just put the two together and saw what fireworks would explode and what I could learn from it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you've put Mike Wilson in a place that I assume that most preachers are going to preach against.
Indeed, and of course, he's an Episcopal priest, which gives me a little leeway. The Episcopal Church is wonderful that way. It has all the smoke and incense, and is also so open to what's going on in the world. There's a point actually where Mike brings himself to the murders occur in the bar, and someone suggests that he's. As a repressed priest, he might be the murderer. And he says, don't you realize Episcopal priests aren't repressed enough? By the time he actually offers to resign, the local diocese comes up with a group of people who stand up for his right to run a topless bar. And he says, wait a minute, I know the difference between a sin and a civil right. So although he is a preacher, he's a very with-it preacher, as so many of our preachers are these days.
Are you challenging Christians or believers? Do you think that most Christians have not been tested, in a sense, and that their faith is too easy for them?
Well, I think it's very important for us all to respect the power of our sexuality. So much of our creativity comes out of it. So much of our energy in a given day comes out of it. And like water in a leaky basement, if you block it up in one area, it'll pop up someplace else. And I think Christians too often are disrespectful of the power of their sexuality, and repressing it isn't the way to do it.
But isn't that what oftentimes the church calls for?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm known, I guess, somewhat facetiously as America's foremost Christian pornographer. We all have our niches, and I seem to have found mine. But it's partly because I feel, if you were to relate me to any other writer that I would feel comfortable with, it would be John Donne and his ideas of the spirit being a raping force. Lord, you know, take me. What better or what image do we have for the power of God's grace at all beyond perhaps the orgasm, which is our physical complement to the spiritual idea of being born again, coming to revelation, having a moment of great power where you're taken out of yourself.
You're saying that the sort of born-again experience, and that's almost become a cliche, is a kind of orgasm?
Well, I'm not saying that it's a kind of orgasm, but if you were feeling for a metaphor for it and something that other people would understand, it's really tough to come up with anything at all, maybe being hit by a truck, but I think the power that is in the sexuality, in our sexuality, has a perfect complement in the power that we have in our spirituality. That doesn't mean that they belong necessarily together. That doesn't mean that you don't have to be very aware of and respectful of the power and danger that is in our sexuality, because it can become obsessive.
Is that considered a rather heretical idea in your church?
Well, I tithe my income, so
so you can say whatever you want.
Having received $500,000 for the movie rights, I have presented to my bishop. I'm not an Episcopalian any longer. I converted from that to Russian Orthodoxy some 12 years ago. My bishop says it's an interesting theological problem whether or not to accept the tithe money from what would be an R-rated movie, but at least it's doing some good.
My guest is D. Keith Mano, and he has served as a contributing editor to both Playboy magazine and the National Review. He's written a whole bunch of books, and his latest book is called Topless. It's a novel. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with D. Keith Mano, and his book is called Topless. Are you now considered somewhat of an authority on topless bars?
I would think, distinguished as that position is in the world, that I might be the authority. But it's not easy because topless is such a pervasive industry, and there are differences in every state and locality. The one thing that is consistent is that it's a money-making proposition wherever it is, and it's getting bigger. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. In Texas, a topless bar called Cabaret Royale that was built for $8 million. It has corporate boardrooms in it and fax machines and Xeroxes, a three-star chef, valet parking, and you can overlook the dance floor while having your corporate board meeting. Things are changing.
Did you set out to be an expert? Was that your goal?
Not really. It was there were a lot of topless bars in my neighborhood. I ran a cement factory in Long Island City, and of course, as a contributing editor to Playboy, I have done all kinds of pieces on sexuality. I've even lived as a transvestite for a period of time, and I'm always aware of our sexuality because it's part of my job and the way I make a living. And it struck me that nobody had written a really deep piece on all the aspects of topless. And I started to research it in the local bars and got to know people and became fascinated with the variety of girls who are working there. Let me say that in general, they tend to be brighter, better educated, and much more interesting than the customers by a long shot. They're all girls of who are taking a certain amount of risk. Most of them are college educated or working their way through college, and they have tremendous stories to tell.
Do they call themselves and each other girls?
Am I being politically incorrect? Please, the ladies at the bar, I don't want to get in any trouble. I just found out that being 5'4", I'm vertically challenged. So cover that one for me, if you will.
No, I think that some adult women call themselves girls and each other's girls, and it's a form of familiarity. So I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just curious if that's the language that they use.
Well, they probably call themselves dancers.
Mm-hmm.
They come, as I say, in great varieties. But what I like to try to get the reader or the listener to empathize with is what I call the great transformation. And it's something that it's very hard to empathize with because it doesn't happen to you or to me, it certainly very seldom happens to men. But imagine an 18-year-old girl who maybe, say, in 80% of the cases comes from a dysfunctional family. Maybe there's alcoholism, maybe there's a divorce, maybe there's a stepfather who's not been all that loving, and certainly there's not much money available to this girl, and she's been bullied by adults. She has no standing in the culture. She leaves home, comes to New York. A friend of hers says, geez, why don't you stop working in this clerical office and try dancing topless? I've been doing it. And she reluctantly, nervously, because she doesn't think that much about her body. She's not necessarily a very beautiful girl. Probably not big busted. Most topless dancers aren't. She goes in and tries it and steps on stage in fear and trepidation. I know one girl who passed out unconscious, fainted away as she made her entrance. She steps out there, and for doing nothing, for standing there and moving around and not falling down, dollar bills begin to fly out of the air, and it's men are listening to this young girl. Previously, men paid no attention. Adults paid no attention. Doctors and lawyers are listening to her every word. She's getting tremendous validation, both from men and in the form of money, and all of a sudden, she's earning $50,000 to $100,000 a year tax-free and is projected into the upper middle class instantly. That's hard for a girl.
Putting the money aside and looking at the kind of relationship between the dancers and the clientele, who has the power here?
That's an interesting point. I think the power is constantly shifted backwards and forwards. Money directs the power to some degree, so the male with the biggest tip will get to sit with and chat with the girl, but ultimately the power in a topless bar lies with the girl. She chooses who she'll spend the half hour between dance sets with talking.
I'm speaking with D. Keith Mano, and his book is called Topless. It's a novel, and it's about an Episcopal priest from a parish in Nebraska who comes to New York City to Queens to manage a topless bar for his brother who has disappeared. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled recently that totally nude dancing was not protected by the First Amendment. It was not guaranteed as a form of free speech. Where do you come down in this ruling, having spent so much time in a topless bar?
Well, I think the Supreme Court ruling is perfectly consistent with other Supreme Court rulings, which makes sense to me. It's up to the locality, I think. There always should be, and historically always has been, a red light district in most cities. The important thing about pornography and as far as bookstores or theaters are concerned, or topless bars, is that they not thrust themselves upon an innocent public, but that there be a place for it to happen safely and comfortably. And as far as topless is concerned, I doubt if it's threatened by anything. It's just too big an industry at this moment. There's just too much money involved. There are, as I've found out through market research, 62,000 women dancing topless in America. Well, figure that out. That's Shea Stadium in New York plus a small theater as well, and maybe 750,000 women who have danced topless. 750,000 at some time in their lives in America.
Well, do you think these women and what they do somehow threaten the morals, the public morals and public order, which is kind of what the Supreme Court referred to?
I don't think it's much of a threat at all. It occurs in a relatively private area. As I've said, it is not in any way a front for prostitution or anything of that kind. I can't see how you could possibly make a case for it being dangerous in any sense. No bodily liquids are exchanged. It's not that different from the performance art that is being sponsored by the National Endowment, so that's not the problem. I don't feel it's an immoral thing. I feel it's a dangerous thing for the participants. It's dangerous because it trivializes feelings, it trivializes the relationship between men and women. Sometimes, if done too obsessively, if a man's only connection with women is his experience with them in topless bars, then he has a distorted picture of women, obviously. And for the women, as I've mentioned, the addiction to money and the addiction to attention and the perhaps disrespect for men that occurs because you can manipulate them so easily, these things are dangerous. But as far as being either a matter of freedom of speech, that I feel that's stretching it, and as far as it being a threat to the community, well, it's been 25 years it's been going on, and it's growing, and is no really that much different from a Las Vegas review.
Do conservatives think differently about sex than liberals?
It's an interesting issue. It's one of those circular things. If you're talking about First Amendment rights and freedom of individuality, very often you run into conservatives standing side by side with liberals. I have always been a libertarian in sexual matters and a conservative in virtually every other area, and I've written at length on pornography and issues of that kind for National Review, which is maybe not entirely comfortable with what I write, but is edited by one of the great men of our time and who's never changed a word of anything that I've written. And a case can be made that on both sides, that although promiscuousness and permissive sexuality is a threat to the family, as a conservative might state, yet on the other hand, these freedoms are to some degree, implied if not guaranteed in the Constitution. So it's an area where I have as many liberal friends as conservative friends.
So do you end up fighting with conservatives about sex and with liberals about everything else?
to some degree, but there are plenty of conservatives who feel that I myself feel it's just not an issue that conservatives should be involved in when there are many, many more problems of much more serious import, like the invasion of our lives that the state has brought about, and the federal government's desire to regulate every part of our lives is much more important an issue, or foreign policy is much more important an issue, and that conservatives just get sucked into an area that's very dangerous and very confusing. The whole Mapplethorpe controversy, for instance, is a waste of an enormous amount of energy on the part of conservatives fighting something that is probably unfightable. It is free speech. It angers me, particularly in the areas where religion is attacked, where an artist is using the energy that comes from religion to give a false boost of a significance to his own art. Those kind of uses, which are purely cynical, are very annoying. But there are more important things for conservatives to think about than pornography or topless dancing.
Now, this Mike Wilson character, he's alive and well in your next book, is that right?
That's right. It looks like it's going to be a series, and one in which Mike is sent to various places as a kind of a troubleshooter for the diocese, and gets to learn more and more about his sexuality and his feelings towards various social phenomena, homosexuality, and other things, and there will be a murder mystery element in all of them, I guess. And I enjoy writing him. I don't in general like writing much at all. It's a painful business, but Mike's voice is natural to me, I guess, and it's been a real pleasure creating him. He's younger, he's handsomer, and he's taller than I am. So I can live a vicarious life through him.
Well, thank you so much, D. Keith Mano, for joining us today.
The pleasure was mine.
D. Keith Mano's book is called Topless. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.